Good morning. This is a meeting of the Air District Stationary Source Committee. We are back from wherever. I want to say it wasn't a summer break from work, but it was a summer break from meetings here at the Air District. May we have roll call?
On the roll for the Stationary Source Committee meeting of September 18th, 2017, Director Canepa.
Here.
Director Groom.
Present.
Director Haggerty. Director Miley. Director Mitchoff. Director Sparing. Director Wagon Connect.
Here.
Committee Vice Chair Sinks.
Here.
Committee Chair Joya.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Great. All right. Brad, lead us in the Pledge of the Flag.
Please join me.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, our first item is public comment, which is the chance for the public to speak on items which are not on our agenda, and each speaker has 3 minutes. Janet Stromberg, followed by Richard Gray, Bob Harlow, and Jan Warren. Those are our four public comment speakers. If you can just... Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Joya and members of the Stationary Source Committee. I'm Janet Stromberg with 350 Bay Area. I also have 28 years of permitting experience implementing the Federal Clean Air Act, the California Clean Air Act, and 25 years experience supervising programs under this at this Air District.
Thank you for all your work at the Air District.
Thank you. We are faced today with the fact that Air District permits have been issued that would collectively give the Bay Area's five refineries license to raise the emissions equivalent of adding a whole new refinery. Those permits are in place. The emissions have not happened. The Bay Area does not need a sixth refinery. This permission was granted because your permit rules are filled with loopholes, in my opinion. On October 18th, the board will be asked to adopt amendments to the permit rules that do not close those loopholes and that also ensure that relaxations that were adopted in your approved amendments in 2012 but have not yet gone into effect will go into effect. The permit program is the fundamental authority you have to regulate stationary source emissions. Proposed amendments deserve your focused attention and your deepest understanding of the nature of the new source review and prevention of significant deterioration permit programs before taking action, before having a hearing. I urge this committee to request that the hearing be delayed and that you, one, use your meetings to better inform yourselves about the underlying purposes and powers of the program. Powers that aren't used are really powers forfeited, and I think there are authorities you have not been fully utilized. Discover how emissions equivalent to adding one new refinery got permitted, and explore how the rules could be amended to better serve your mission and the public who rely on your decisions. Thank you.
Thank you. Richard Gray.
Good morning, committee members. Richard Gray with 350 Bay Area. Some time ago, the staff and board promised to bring Rule 1216 forward in September. So here it is, September. And the reason that the staff took it off the agenda, in my opinion, is bogus. Their claim about legislative intent was misleading and false. Not only have we learned that the wording of AB 398 was intentional and clear and does not preclude capping CO2, the Assembly legislative analyst says that the language is clear. We do not have a legal issue. We have a political issue. And your staff made a political decision to take 1216 off the agenda, which they had no right to do. You are the politicians who represent us. We need you to make the political decisions for this agency. And we want it put back on the agenda. not just for CO2, but also for PM, as you committed to do in May of this year. The recent unnatural weather that we've experienced around the world is another wake-up call. We have another string of tornadoes heading towards the United States. There is a real emergency that is coming upon this earth. And I really want you to be able to say to your children and grandchildren that you did everything that you could do. This regional agency has enormous power to do something about climate change. And here's one way that you can do something about it that'll make a real difference. Thanks.
Thank you. Bob Harlow, followed by Jan Warren, followed by Steve Nadell.
Hi, my name is Bob Harlow. I am representing the Mill Valley Community Action Network, which is one of, I would say, several dozen indivisible type groups that have cropped up around the Bay Area. And a bunch of activist constituents who are looking at any number of things, but I have to say that climate is on the radar of all of them. Public health is clearly on the radar of people in your districts, Mr. Spinks, your district, Mr. Haggerty, your district. I noticed that last month, particulate matter, which causes illness and death from lung disease and cancer, was on the agenda. I noticed it's not on the agenda this month. We know, and you have said, that carbon dioxide and particulate matter are so closely correlated to be essentially the same thing, which is pollution. So we're not at a point, we're in an, this is an industry, you're in the position of regulating an industry that by any standards needs to be nearly irrelevant 30 years from now. So it's very hard to understand why this industry is being allowed to expand now before it gets reduced. I think it's important to stop PM now, and it's important to stop CO2 now at a very minimum, and you have such a simple tool to do that, and I really encourage you to bring that back for the sake of the health of the people in your districts and for the sake of the health of the climate. Thank you very
much. Thank you. Jan Warren.
Good morning. Jan Warren from the Contra Costa Interfaith Climate Action Network. At the May 31st board meeting, there was a majority vote to revise Rule 1216 to cap emissions from the Bay Area refineries and to prepare a revised staff report and final EIR reflecting the revised vote. In June, the staff presented a revision that would have actually increased emissions rather than follow the direction the board had issued to staff. We have been told the board would revisit Rule 1216, yet here we are in September with no Rule 1216 on the agenda. You must keep your word. You must recognize that risk assessment doesn't equate to cumulative impact. People are much more than statistics. The Bay Area Air District must prioritize the health and safety of Rodeo and Bay Area residents who shoulder the burden of processing dirty, volatile sands crude. Allowing refineries to simply pay fines when they are caught breaking a regulation is not enough. We know that 80% of the reduction we've experienced in air pollution has been from regulations. SB 398 does not pre-exempt capping emissions. You need to stop the staff from rubber stamping permits that will increase pollution and further harm residents, our water, and air. I attended a Phillips 66 scoping meeting in Vallejo. The meeting was taped. Staff let everyone speak. And I would ask members to have access and actually listen to the residents speaking because they can't come to these meetings. Otherwise, it gets kind of filtered through staff and you get a little summary of what people said, but you don't get their emotion. You don't get their life experience. Consider the cumulative impact of people who left Katrina because they were flooded out, went to Houston. Gosh,
another hurricane, their experience and their trauma to their family and their health is a lot different than someone who just recently moved to Houston. So if you think of someone who is living in by a refinery, they're pregnant, they have a baby, they've lived there all their lives, there's cumulative health effects from the parent, the grandparent to the parent to the baby, and the baby, you know, by this time probably has an inhaler because this process has been so slow. People's lives depend on action. We need accountability, transparency, timelines, and appreciate y'all's work. Thank you.
Thank you. Steve Nadell, followed by, is it Marie Kiever? That was the last card I have.
Good morning, Steve Nadell with Sunflower Alliance. What's not on the agenda today speaks more to the issues than what actually is. The Phillips 66 wharf expansion, if combined with the permitted input of that expansion combined with the baseline input from the Santa Maria facility, amounts to a 15% increase on the maximum capacity of that refinery. Yet another example of the ongoing way the permitting process has allowed the refineries to continually expand to, as when we were talking in August, the proposal from staff for regulating CO2 was the equivalent of adding a sixth refinery. How can we achieve the goals that we look at in 1118 and our future climate action programs if we allow the baseline to expand this far to where we're continually permitting additional capacity in these refineries, which translates directly to not only additional CO2 and toxic pollutants like particulate matter, but as most of these projects will eventually enable the movement of tar sands and even greater intensity per unit processed of PM and CO2. While we admire the goals of efforts like 1118, those are a year, if not decade-long process. And if the permitting process continues as it is, the baseline will far exceed any reductions that that process can achieve. So what we ask you is to honor your votes. You have voted repeatedly to direct staff to bring a reasonable cap on total emissions of CO2 and particulate matter from the refineries in order to set the baseline for these future improvements, prevent the tar sands from coming in. Honor those votes, get the process moving again, and let us protect our communities. Thank you.
Thank you. The last speaker card I have in public comment, Marie Kiever.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Marcy Kiever.
Oh, Marcy. And I'm not always good at reading handwriting.
It happens. And I'm the legal director at Friends of the Earth. I'm here on behalf of 27 organizations that sent your whole board a letter on August 1st regarding your authority to promulgate Rule 1216. We're urging you to follow through with your commitment to set limits that backstop and cap refinery greenhouse gas emissions at current levels. The authority of the Air District to cap refinery emissions is not impacted by AB 398 for three very specific reasons. First, AB 398's plain language only applies to emission reductions, not to caps set at current levels, which is all Rule 1216 proposed to do. Second, assembly floor analysis from AB 398 confirms that limiting future emission increases is different than an emission reduction rule. This confirms that the plain language of AB 398 should be read narrowly and does not limit district authority when it comes to Rule 1216. Third, other provisions of the Health and Safety Code actually support this interpretation. The district has outlined all of the reasons why Rule 1216 is necessary for the district to meet and achieve regional, state, climate, and health protection goals. AB 398 does not limit that authority. Given 398, the district's, your leadership and action is even more critical. Given all of these facts, we continue to ask the district to move ahead with rules like 1216 that cap emissions at current levels to prevent increases in the Bay Area. Thank you.
Thank you. That was the last speaker card I have. Jack, why don't you just note, I know we can't discuss items under public comment, but just to note, there is an agenda item on Wednesday's board meeting on refinery issues. Did you want to just briefly clarify that? Because a couple of folks mentioned there wasn't something on the agenda. There is something general. It's not specific. I know some have asked for. There is an agenda item on Wednesday.
Right. Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Yes, on Wednesday we have actually two items that I want to make you aware of. One is essentially a review of all the actions that the district is in the process of taking and a plan to take relative to refinery emissions and protecting communities. And there's a second item also that we're going to brief you about, and that's a bill that was recently signed into law. And indeed, the budget change proposal was signed by the governor as early as Friday, I believe. And this is AB 617 implement 617. This bill begins to establish a very robust and a comprehensive set of efforts on behalf of the state and the districts working together to not only establish monitoring networks, but also community emission reduction plans. So there's a lot to this story that we want to walk you through on Wednesday, Mr. Chairman. So those are the two items that are going to be talked about. One is a little bit more specific to refinery emissions. The other is really also, for the board's benefit, a discussion about AB 617 implementation and all the work that is ahead of us on that effort.
There was also a comment about when there would be any presentation here on the Phillips 66 project. Do you want to tell us the timing that you're thinking about of when we will get a presentation on that?
Well, we just only initiated the scoping document for the refinery project there at Phillips 66. And indeed, that is a permitting action that's going to be taken or is part of a permitting action relative to the refinery there. And so I think it's appropriate that we have a discussion about a broader discussion with the Stationary Source Committee about refinery projects in general, not necessarily explicitly on that item. So I want to put it in the context of other refinery efforts.
When are you anticipating scheduling that?
That permitting action wouldn't even take place till, I want to say, the first quarter and possibly even the second quarter of next year. So I would suggest either between now and the end of the year having that conversation about the refinery projects, a stationary source committee.
What's the EIR timing on the Phillips project?
I'll let you know.
So as Speaker mentioned, we did have public meetings
right. And
public comment period on the scoping for that EIR, and the consultant is underway with that EIR. It usually takes at least 9 months to put together the draft, so it'll be sometime next year.
Okay. So it sounds like sometime this year, fall this year, we'll be having some type of presentation on that and other projects.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, and I'll come back to you on an explicit date.
All right. So moving on to item 3, which is approval of the minutes of April 17th. Is there a motion or any changes? Is there a motion?
Make the motion to approve the minutes.
Motion and a second. We're like a little slow the first meeting back from the summer here. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Item passes. Item 4 is an update on the wood smoke program.
Good morning, Chair Joya. This morning, staff's going to give an update on our multifaceted wood smoke reduction program, and Wayne Kino, our Director of Compliance and Enforcement, will give the staff presentation.
Good morning, Chair Joya, members of the Stationary Source Committee. I'm Wayne Kino. I'm Director of Compliance and Enforcement, and I'm here to give you an update on the wood smoke program and what to anticipate for this next season. A little background, we usually show the slide every year. It gives you a look back at the number of days over the standard versus the number of winter spare the air alerts we called. You can see we haven't exceeded the past 2 years. And because of rule changes that the Board of Directors passed, we were able to proactively look ahead, project spare the air days over the limit or days projected over the limit in advance and winter spare the air alerts in advance. So we've avoided some excesses due to that. This is another table that we show. It gives you a summary of the first two rows are similar to the previous slide. The next one shows the number of complaints we had, which is about 1,500 complaints this past year. It's on par with previous years, given the wet winter. Information packs, ironically, the same number of packets we sent out. Violations, 91 violations this past year. And the number of exemptions, we had 129 permanent exemptions and plus one seasonal exemption. The seasonal exemption is when a heater breaks. It's allowed in the rule that if a heater breaks during the year, people can try and get it repaired. They have so much time to repair, and it qualifies for an exemption for the rest of the season. The enforcement highlights, 91 total violations. 69 first-time violators. They get to take the smoke awareness course, which is similar to the DMV, for ticket course, and or pay a $100 penalty. We had, and usually is the case, one person pays the penalty, and the rest take the course. It's an online course. It's very easy to take. It's an educational opportunity. 21 second or third-time violations. Those carry fines, and the one visible emission violation that we had, where one of our inspectors actually documented a visible emission coming from the chimney. 117 total exemptions. We had, this is the first year that the rule required EPA certified devices be used on spare the air days as sole source of heat, and we had 116 registered. You have to be registered also. Complaints, just a little detail on the complaints, 40 addresses with five or more complaints, five addresses with 20, two with 50, and 84 complaints filed by one person. The Winter Spare the Air campaign, you know, the wood smoke program is a combination of enforcement, advertising, and the incentive program that we had, so it's a really good program to fully get emission reductions from this category. So the messaging campaign this year will again emphasize the health impacts of wood smoke. We'll conduct advertising as we did before, advertising in social media, public relations, and emphasizing that again. Advertising surveys conducted in various languages, English, Spanish, Mandarin, and Cantonese. And we will again go door to door with surveys in targeted neighborhoods to try and judge the effectiveness of our rule. This is a rather complicated graphic. We just want to put up here to show you the various ways that we get the spare the air message out and the number of areas in which we target. We try and target the whole Bay Area. With various kinds of campaigns, the door-to-door surveys try to measure the effectiveness of that. And it's been very effective because, as I said, this is an integral part of this whole program is the educational part. The Wood Smoke Reduction Incentive Program, the board allocated $3 million for this program. And if you see, that's the categories in which we will pay to homeowners who apply, $750 to just take a wood-burning device out, $1,000 if you replace it with a natural gas device, and $3,500 for a heat pump. We try to target high-impacted areas in the Bay Area. The results of the program itself. If you see the map shows the various places where people have applied and been granted grants. If you look at the number, the amounts of payments we've had out so far is a little over 2,300,000, about 1.5 million in the highly impacted areas. And if you see that, it looks like 83 were decommissioned, 877 were replaced with a gas device, and 54 heat pumps were installed. So what are the next steps for this program? So we're going to close out the grant portion of this project. There's about 300 out of the 1,000 applications that are still waiting for install or verification of the installs. We're going to continue coordinating with the ARB CAPCOA group to get future funding. The state has approved $5 million statewide. We're trying to see what portion of that we can gather for this district. There's a proposed $50 million in future years for this program statewide. And, you know, we anticipate getting our portion of that money. So there seems to be quite a bit of money coming for this program down the pike. And so what we wanted to do here is taking the remainder $700,000, $600,000 to $700,000 that's remaining in this program and focus it in an area that we can measure the effectiveness of this program. So far, the effectiveness of this program has been calculated based on the change outs and how much particulates or how much material these each individual stove or whatever puts out. And it's really a calculation. So what we wanted to do is really hone in on the emission reductions for this particular program. What actually are we getting out of this program? So we're going to pick a few areas. We're going to focus our outreach, monitoring, enforcement, and the remaining grant funds on these areas during this next season. And we're going to try and take those areas, measure how much particulates are emitted during that time period. We have baselines for those areas. And try and get a really an effectiveness of this program. And using that information, we want to come back to the committee with a targeting format. You know, we're going to be getting some of this $5 million, $50 million money coming down the road. And to try and effectively use that and target that money in the future, we're going to use this information. So we thought that would be a reasonable approach, something that would assure emission reductions, utilize the money to the best ability we can, and that would be our goal for this next round. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Okay. We have a question by Director Haggerty.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, just a couple questions. So just real quick, it appears to me let me make an observation first, and it appears in the high wood smoke areas that we don't have a lot of completed projects, but I'll follow that up with a comment that maybe says, I understand these may be rural type areas, so maybe there's not a ton of projects in those areas. So I'll say that, understanding that. But when you look at an entire zip code and you only see one project, and in some areas we see no projects, that's of concern. And then if I kind of take the map and I lay it over the targeted outreach, and I know you talked about expanding the outreach, I heard that. It appears that we're not doing a lot in those areas. And so to me that seems like, I want to be nice. We missed the mark, I think, is what I would say. So there's several questions going on here. And then when I look at, say, for example, Livermore, I feel sorry for the guy when he's riding his bike down 580, but that's his business. But, you know, we have also engaged with the local transit agencies to wrap the buses in some areas, and I don't see any of that noted. So there's several questions in there.
Okay. So you're correct that these high wood smoke areas tend to be more rural. The grant program was a first-come, first-serve program. So we looked at, we opened up the program, we took the applications, it was fully subscribed fairly quickly, and we put people on the wait list. And then we started to distribute the money based on first-come, first-serve. We did allocate some money for highly impacted areas, low-income. That was our board direction. We did that, and we put aside that money. But that's partially why we wanted to take this future tact of looking at both the emission reductions, measure the emission reductions, target those areas. These rural areas and plus these highly impacted areas, we're in there quite often already. We do door-to-door there. The inspection staff engages those staff out there. We do also do community meetings out in those areas. And maybe that's not reflected in the advertisement here. But those areas we do target. We do utilize a lot of other means of communications and not just the advertising that's out there. You know, a lot of these places, for instance, Marin, they don't even have mail service. They go to a central mailbox, so it's difficult to even mail things out to them. So we need to hone that strategy and try and get it right. And I think you're absolutely right, Director Haggerty. We need to improve that, and that's what we're trying to do here.
Okay, and then if I could, as we were working through the wood smoke ordinance, I several times remember being reminded that Livermore was an area of high wood smoke concentration. And then if I look on the map, I don't see that reflected. Why?
Okay. You're talking about the high, what we consider the highly impacted areas?
Yeah, and I was told that Livermore was one of them.
Well,
several times in meetings and on maps. And
I think in terms of wood smoke and during the winter spare the air season, we didn't designate it as a highly impacted area simply because we did a combination of both measurement, and we also did a combination of how many complaints and how many violations we've had in the past. We haven't had a whole lot of violations in the Livermore area, although I've sent a lot of patrols out there to try and, you know, with complaints and so forth over the years. We don't get that much in terms of violations and or smoking people, you know, out there. So, you know.
Well, I'm going to stop you because this is like a 180 from what I've been told in the past. We were told, and in fact, we had a special meeting out in Livermore because it was an area of high impact. So all of a sudden I'm hearing now it's not an area. And so if I want to be the conspiracy theorist, I would say the reason you dropped it off is because you didn't want to give any money into that area. Although if I look on the map, I do see that people in that area applied. I'm just saying what you're saying is a 180 from what we heard when we were developing that wood smoke ordinance. And I don't understand it.
So I think there might be, do you want to? There are two things here. Relative to our other grants program, that area is identified as being highly impacted based on the impacts of
Damien, I just want to be clear, and I'm not going to get in a big argument with you, meaning I'm going to stand down here in a second. And, I'm not. But what I'm saying to you is specifically to wood smoke.
Okay.
I realize that area is impacted by a lot of other things. What happens in the 880 corridor settles in the 580 corridor in the afternoon. I understand all that. I get that. We are specifically talking about wood smoke right now. And I'm saying that I have consistently been told up until this moment that Livermore was an area of high impact. In fact, you all went out there and did a hearing on it. And now all of a sudden it's not. It just seems weird to me. Kind of like it seemed weird to me when we were trying to convince me that there was no pollution on the 580 corridor for a long time, and finally we discovered there was.
Director Haggerty, maybe if I can help a little bit. We know and feel and believe that the I'll call it the Tri-Valley area, the Livermore area, is a care community in that you have high concentrations of diesel PM out that way.
Exactly.
You have ozone concentrations out there. You have PM concentrations that are a result of what we call secondary PM. Is it a wood smoke area? I need to go back and talk to the staff a little bit more about that.
Yeah. Well, maybe, Jackson, so when we were in the old building and all the other stuff you were telling me when we were developing the wood smoke ordinance, and you were making my life very uncomfortable as a public official out in that area, and now I'm just hearing a different song, and it just doesn't make sense to me.
The other aspect I'll just mention also is that that area we know also experiences high wood smoke, in part due to transport from the Central Valley, too. I did want to point this out. Under offshore wind conditions, you'll see particularly wood smoke and particularly ag burning moving into that portion of it. As far as people burning wood in their fireplaces or wood stoves, Director Haggerty, I'd like to get a better sense about that in that area, and we can come back to you about that.
And we were told that that was happening because they were older communities, and that's what they did.
Okay.
I would like some follow-up. I'm not going to beat this up.
No, no.
Leave it here for now, but I would like some follow-up. Just real quick, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate it. Not knowing the map and not knowing really the area, I mean, I know the map, I understand the Bay Area, but where is San Geronimo Valley, and then how have we done in that area? Which zip code is it?
It's Marin County, and it's...
Is it what?
Kind of central Marin County, if you will.
Read me the zip code. It's got to be one of them. What? Okay. So we did nothing in there? I see zero dots.
Yeah, we did not.
So how are we doing in relationship to wood smoke there?
Well, you know, a lot of that...
Is that where the person that's complained 83 times lives?
No, but that area has no... Well, actually, all the high-impacted areas have limited or no natural gas service. And most of those homes have EPA-certified stoves in them already. So we had a lot of registrations in that valley. And so that's another thing that we need to target to see how we can get something like heat pumps in that area, something that uses electricity and not the changeouts. The changeouts are focused, if you saw, focused mainly on natural gas going in for wood burning devices. It didn't service a lot of the heat pumps.
I would add, Director Haggerty, that was an area where we did spend a lot of time doing outreach. We worked with the county itself. We had folks doing presentations, doing door-to-door. So it is kind of the factors, and that's something that we're trying to understand by the program that we're proposing. What are the factors that are not allowing these folks to upgrade? This would be one of the areas that we'd be proposing to look at, to measure, and then to concentrate some resources on as part of this next step in the program.
Yeah, and the other thing I want to mention, Director Haggerty, is that our program is not the sole program up in Marin County. We did give money, and there's still money left over for changeouts to EPA certified for that area. So the Marin County runs a program to change out uncertified wood-burning devices to EPA-certified devices up there. So that, in combination with our program, we're trying to get the most bang for the buck.
Okay, and just two more things real quick, Mr. Chairman. I think what I would like to see is how well we have done in that area or have not, because for me that was the impetus of how I wanted to move forward with the wood smoke. And we had people down that were testifying that were, you know, they were telling us horror stories, and I would like to zero in directly in there and see how we've done in the past couple of years, to be very honest with you. So I'd like to see that come back in some form. I hope it doesn't have to be a special report on San Geronimo Valley. That's not what I'm asking for, but you can figure out a way to slip it into the agenda. And then I think just real quick, I want to say that as somebody who's trying to do a major project in Livermore right now, or actually in Pleasanton, that requires contractors, I can tell you the price of contracting is going up substantially. And we may, as we move forward and look at maybe doing other, trying to roll out another project, we might want to look at this $1,000 number and say, or the decommission number, and say this just is not enough. And we may want to look at maybe enhancing it a little bit, maybe the $750 to $1,000, the $1,000 to $1,500. I don't know what it is, but, you know, the price of getting things done, and even if you can find a contractor to get something done, it's very difficult. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We've got a few folks. Director Sinks was next, Director Groom, and then Director Wagon Connect. Oh, so why don't we just take it in order?
Sure.
Is that okay with directors? You want to take?
No.
You okay with that? Let's
sure.
Just start from
thank
this end.
Thank you very much, Chair Joya.
Carol, okay with that?
Thank you, Wayne. That was great. I'm glad you sort of told us what was going on. I'm just kind of curious. There was some kindling taking place in San Francisco at the Russian consulate. Sorry.
Burning documents is kindling. Huh?
Yes. I'm just curious. I have a little background in terms of, you know, embassies and consul generals. What authority do you have as an agency relative to the consulate of Russia?
Interesting. when they were burning, you know, just like any other place in the Bay Area, we would respond to either complaints or reports of something happening, you know, a complaint of some sort, either odors, smoke from coming from a chimney. So we did respond. We will respond regardless of where it is and what our authority is. You know, we do, within our authority, smoking chimneys, smoking things burning, burning garbage, things other than dry wood are within our authority. Whether we have authority on the consulate grounds is another matter. We do, even if it's not within our authority, when we do respond to things, we try and do a compliance outreach type of thing. We try and get people to cooperate. We talk to them. We try and engage in conversation, how it's impacting their neighbors, neighborhood, region in general. So even if we don't have authority on something that we respond to, and we don't have authority on a lot of things we respond to, we do try to do this outreach and try and educate. And that's what the inspection staff does as a course of action, as a matter of normal business. So, you know, regardless whether we have clear authority, we would still try and engage that and try to.
And Director Canepa, if I can maybe add to Mr. Kino's remarks, this program may not necessarily be our most popular program. A lot of folks don't necessarily want to be told not to burn wood on particularly when we have to call it on a Thanksgiving or a Christmas. You can understand that. But here we were faced with a situation where black smoke was coming out of the Russian consulate. And we knew ourselves that that's sovereign soil, that it may not be able to actually have our authority apply to it. But we did ask ourselves, listen, if we ask the Bay Area residents to take these steps on Spare the Air days, we're going to apply that authority even to the Russian consulate as well. So we did, and that's the steps we took. Now, we may find ourselves having that NOV kicked out. Just that is a real distinct possibility. I'll let the board know that. But we felt it was appropriate and took that step.
And so my understanding is there's no one there. Have they vacated the premises, or are there people still there at the consulate?
They were required to be vacated
on that Saturday, the Friday that they're gone. Yeah, they're gone.
So my question is how do you educate someone who's not there?
Yeah.
Well, we sent it to Putin.
Yeah. But Jack, you heard there was some press out of Moscow that criticized the Air District as part of anti-Russian sentiment. So I guess we got a little publicity in Moscow for doing this.
Yeah. A little bit of self-incriminating publicity. They admitted that they were burning oil in the in the fireplace. So
it looked,
it's not looking good for them if we have authority.
So he said, well, you know, we know they interfered with our elections. Now they're interfering with our air quality. That's right. Director Groom.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I have just an overall concern about this closing out projects and not spending some money and kind of refocusing. Well, during the budget hearings, we specifically talked about this being one of our most important programs and we should have additional funds added to it. So now you've confused me by saying that we're going to repurpose ourselves and look at four areas of concern, which you didn't tell us what they were. But I'm really concerned. I am concerned about that. I know that we have on the San Mateo coast, we have a lot of people that are wood burning, and we get a lot of complaints about that. We've also have specific zip codes in our Supervisor Canepa's area and my area that we do hear from. And so I'm a little concerned about kind of re-tinkering a program after we've had a budget hearing and then we didn't hear that there was new thoughts underway.
So, Director Groom, no, very good points. This is an update, and this represents the evolution of our thinking here. So we have about $750,000 left over that basically because that money was out and not all of it was taken. So we're repurposing that money for the high impact areas. In fact, Wayne, if you want to cover exactly how we expect to spend that money.
Sure.
Director Groom, but you're a little bit ahead of me. What I was going to do was ask this committee if we want to also then take a little bit of more money out of our reserves, because this is what we talked about in terms of the Budget and Finance Committee for this fiscal year, is to take a little bit more money and put it into this program. Part of why we are not explicitly saying that to you today, because there's been a lot of progress in Sacramento with regard to a bill, Laura's bill, and Mr. Kino referred to it as the $50 million. If that gets signed by the governor, then indeed we could see as much as $10 million coming back to us, about 20% of that money. And if that, we'd like to see that then used, and we would ask ourselves then how much do we put in if the state's willing to fund us as much as $10 million. So we're still thinking we're going to take money. We're still thinking we want to put it to this high priority program because it is one of the more successful programs we have. It's reduced PM during high concentrations. We basically are coming into compliance with the PM standard because of this program. And so we're just a couple of months away from coming back to you with a recommendation. Feel that that'll be a subsequent conversation with this committee to say this was passed or this was not passed, and as a result, we're going to recommend to you a million more in addition to the $750,000 that are being repurposed. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. But I also don't want to see us stop what we're doing now.
Absolutely.
Especially if we receive complaints and we know that there are certain areas that are visibly affected by this.
We like this program in the sense that not only do we have the hammer, if you will, the ticket book, but you've also got money into this program. And so we put our money where our mouth is. So, as I mentioned, it's been a very successful program. So we'd like the opportunity to come back to this committee in a couple of months, just when all that settles out in Sacramento. Governor hopefully signs that bill. We get $10 million, and then we're going to ask maybe this committee to direct us to spend some of our own monies in a slightly different way. So let us see where the Sacramento legislation goes.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Director Miley.
Thank you. The only question I have is the Spare the Air campaign. What's the focus of that with the sharks? What do you do? Sounds like sharks. What are you doing?
We just put advertising banners up around the Sharks Arena. It's a wintertime sport. It's where we can get a lot of eyeballs on our messaging so that people pay attention to it.
Have you approached the Warriors? The arena?
I believe we did, but it may have been out of our budget. We do the A's, we do the Sharks, we do the sporting arenas where we can fit it within our budget.
Okay.
But we can check again with the Warriors, but they're typically fairly high.
Okay.
They used to not be, but in the last like three or four years, the cost has gone up quite a bit.
No comment on some of our other sports franchises in the South Bay.
Carol and I say go Bears.
Hell no. Okay. I wanted to go back to the complaints and violations page a bit. We have 40 addresses with 5 or more complaints, 5 with 20 or more. We've only seen 1 visible emissions violation. Given that the level of complaints, it must be by, I don't know if there's one person that's doing all this or if you have multiple people, but it would seem like residents are talking about what's going on at their neighbors' houses. If we've only had 1 visible emissions complaint, how do you get the other 68?
Well, the visible emission violation requires that our staff actually read it.
Yeah.
So it's 3 minutes in an hour. It's a standard which they have to exceed.
But you put out 69 first time, 21
right.
second. If your inspector's not on site, how do those NOVs get?
Those NOVs are basically burning on a no burn day.
Okay.
So it's not the visible can happen on any day. It doesn't have to be a no burn day. It could be a burn day,
I see.
And a visible could violate that. Most of the complaints that come in are for burning on a Spare the Air day. So we do a patrol for that in both morning. We vary it morning, evening, afternoon to try and capture those. But usually those calls come in either very early in the morning or very late at night. So it's not something that we can respond to really, really quickly. We do it through patrols.
So when you only have 1 visible emissions violation, you've issued a total of 69 plus 21 NOVs. This last year, right?
We issued 91 total, 69 first time, 21. Yeah, that all adds up to 91.
And if your inspector hasn't done a visible emissions violation, hasn't taken those readings. How do you, on what basis do you offer a violation, a violation?
You could be burning, but not on a no-burn day, but not violate the visible emission criteria. So in the regulation 6 that the board adopted, section 309 is a visible emission standard, so they can't exceed that. Okay. The rest of the sections, 301, 302, basically are burning on a no-burn day kind of violation.
And so you have other ways to determine that that's
correct.
Happening.
Oh, correct.
Okay. So that helps my confusion.
Any smoke, any burning on a no-burn day is actually a violation if we would capture that.
I mean, given all these complaints, do we need better, do you think we need more resources for enforcement?
No. I think that, you know, a lot of the complaints, as I said, come in towards the evening, even if we go out. I've gone out in Marin in the San Geronimo Valley. It is so dark out there, I can't even see the houses. When it's burning, you can't determine which one's burning at a time. So it's mm-hmm. it's a difficult criteria to get out in some of those remote areas. You know, if it's a well-lighted area, you can see that. But a lot of these things are very difficult to get. So what we do is, because this program has matured so much since the very beginning when we first started doing that, we did patrols exclusively early on in this program. As the season goes along nowadays, we do patrols early in the season. And as we get towards the end of the season, when the message has gotten out to everybody, everyone knows not to burn, we then try and do targeted inspections. So we target some of these high complaint ones, and we go out and we try and camp on those a bit at times.
So we know that some forms of pollution from industrial facilities put out through stacks swim around in the entire Bay Area and collect in certain communities. How much of wood smoke is localized? I'm sure there's a disproportionate effect on people living nearby, but how much of it gets around in the atmosphere and swims around and becomes a problem for all of us?
Are you talking regionally, or we're talking?
Yeah, I'm talking regionally. How much of that wood smoke becomes a regional problem?
Yeah. During the season, a lot of that material, when we get to the hot days or the days with the inversion on the Bay Area, that transport can go from Marin all the way down the valley into Livermore, into San Jose. So there is quite a bit of transport during that time period. That's why when the board adopted the last rule revision, we put into the rule an ability to project forward, not just the day before, but project forward and call Spare the Air Day a day or two prior to that, so we can project build up in the whole region and try and eliminate excesses, which I think has been very successful. So the rule now allows us to project 2 or 3 days in advance that we project a Spare the Air Day may happen and call a Spare the Air Day prior to that, or an excess may happen.
So on the one hand, you know, if we're in a rural community, it's hard to do marketing there. We may not have billboards and other things. Maybe we could make deals to put up signs and things and private property that don't exist today. But there aren't as many people directly impacted. But what you're saying is, when we have an inversion, we should all care about trying to reduce the wood smoke, even when we don't live there.
Yes.
Even if we're directors up here representing counties that don't have as much of a problem, I guess, right?
Yes.
Okay.
That's true.
Director Sinks, on your previous question about inspectors, for this budget year, we did actually enhance the number of positions for enforcement. Just wanted to remind you for the budget you adopted back in June.
That all went by pretty fast, so I appreciate the comment, given the other business we had that day. I'm wondering if it makes sense to make one map with some overlays. That is, if we could get a map with an estimate of remaining targets. You know, maybe it's density, maybe it's actual how many people in this area with some icons representing 10 or 15 or 20 or something. And then grant uptake on top of that, and then our marketing efforts on top of that. Maybe we could get three slides that would all blend together. Maybe you'd have to take it apart to get clarity, but at least I think it would help maybe to have an overlay, because it sort of looks like the marketing slide doesn't even cover the full area of Backbite's the Air District's jurisdiction.
We can do that.
That would be my suggestion, okay, to make it maybe easier to see where we're where we might target where we haven't. So
okay.
And I appreciate Carol's remarks too about thinking that it would make sense for us to continue resources. I mean, after all, we're going into the winter season. If we close out, we're out of money. We got the stick, but we don't have a carrot to go with it during the winter season. You know, it's a more difficult message to peddle.
Okay.
Thank you.
Brad?
Thank you. My two questions were kind of going in the same direction as Director Sinks, but I won't go over a lot of that, but we might, with the new technology, we might look at night vision or whatever, the heat sensing, because we get out in rural Napa and you can't see what's going on, and yet, especially at night, and it might be helpful to see that, and they're not that expensive these days. The other one is in the production of wood smoke and the transport of wood smoke. To me, that would seem, high production but high transport would be an area that we want to really focus on, the areas we want to focus on.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any closing thoughts you have?
No.
You heard a lot from the board.
I did.
Yes. All right. Is there anything else on this item anyone wishes to raise? Okay. With that, we will move on to...
Director, I believe, yes, that there's some public comment on this, Chairperson.
Are there? Let me see. Oh, thank you. I had him under five, so thank you. I have two cards, Janet Stromberg and Richard Gray.
Good morning again. Janet Stromberg from 350 Bay Area, and I want to remind you that the whole initiative behind the new work that the Air District is doing on wood smoke was prompted by the Marin organization Families for Clean Air, and we observed their strong presentation to the board, and 350 Bay Area joined with them to help their effort, and our objectives are also, in addition to the health impacts of PM, is to address the black carbon and the CO2 emissions from wood smoke and see if the program can further those objectives as well. If we could look at slide 7, please. I have a very personal stake in this. I want to remove my fireplace, and I'm actually looking for a contractor for a big job that could involve that. And honestly speaking, there's probably no one that wants their fireplace to look like the picture on the left. And the heat pumps on the right is really the gold standard for what we would like to see in the future in the Bay Area, and to enable people who have no other source of heat besides wood to be able to get electric heat pumps would be a tremendous value to the Bay Area. It wasn't clear, the natural gas conversion money that was spent, was it all for fireplace inserts? Because if it was all for fireplace inserts, I think we should rethink the grant program and focus on a public relations campaign about actually getting rid of fireplaces, which costs substantially more than $750, just decommissioning. And a two-pronged program. One is to the public to educate them more about the dangers of wood smoke and offer more money. Not very many people would be able to get it, but it would be the beginning of people understanding that you can get rid of your fireplace, and the result can be very nice. And particularly more money really targeted on those homes that need to have a new clean source of heat, and for people that can't afford that. So that is... what I'm requesting of you when you're looking at your funding formulas, to question giving money, any money at all, for natural gas conversion, because that's really an aesthetic discretionary choice. And there's an added benefit to removing a fireplace in the Bay Area, because you're getting rid of a chimney and a whole lot of brick that's going to come down in an earthquake and cause more damage to your homes. So there's something to be gained by taking that more seriously. Thank you.
Thank you. Richard Gray.
I want to thank the staff for making an excellent report on this matter, and also very heartened by the interest that all of the board have shown on this issue. It's of great importance to me because I live in a high wood smoke impact area in Forest Knolls. So thank you very much, Director Haggerty, for paying particular attention to the San Jerome Valley. We have an inversion there that in the wintertime creates a blanket of smoke over the community. And if Wayne drives in there and can't see anything, it's because we don't really have lighting there. So I really like the idea of that Director, I think it was Wagon Connect, mentioned of bringing some night vision or even just a big old flashlight mounted on the truck to spot where smoke is coming from. I literally cannot go outdoors during the winter when there's no wind and it's very cold and people are using their fireplaces. The other thing is I want to reiterate what Janet was just speaking about in terms of eligibility for a new round of funding. I think it's really important that we take natural gas and propane, which is what is used in the area where I am, out of the replacement funding. In 350 Bay Area, we're currently working on an advocacy program called Electrify Everything. The point of that is that if we're ever going to meet both the state's and the district's goals for GHG reductions and wood smoke reduction, we have to stop investing in fossil fuel devices. They have probably a 50-year life, and we're looking to have our air cleaner much sooner than that. So I'd really appreciate it if you I think the staff is already onto this, but if we could eliminate natural gas devices and go for heat pumps, that would be a good thing. Thank you.
Thank you. That was the last speaker card I have. All right. Item 5 is an update on Draft Regulation 11, Rule 18, reduction of risk from toxic air emissions at existing facilities. And just as one comment, I know, Jack, you're going to give an update on this. Mm-hmm. While all the other rules we're working on are all important, I think this rule especially is going to protect communities around facilities that have toxic emissions. And so of all the rules we're working on, this one will probably have the most, we have to implement it correctly and quickly, will have some of the most immediate health benefits for communities around these types of facilities. So I just wanted to note that. And it's a very significant, groundbreaking rule.
So again, good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. And I think Director Joy, you just said what I would say as introducing this item. Draft Regulation 11, Rule 18 is one of the most important public health efforts we have underway, and it's really designed to be able to reduce toxic air contaminants from stationary sources, continue to reduce toxic air contaminants. What we're going to lay out for you is a proposal that would be the most stringent proposal to do this, not only in the state of California, but we think also across the country. I'm going to hand it over to Damien to add to my remarks, and then I know he'll introduce Jamie.
So I think we've heard from our communities across the Bay Area over the last few years. You've heard it in practically every community that folks are concerned about health impacts from facilities. This particular regulation builds on the work that we did back in December of 2006. We adopted Regulation 2, Rule 5, which looks at new sources of air pollution that are moving in. This particular rule addresses existing sources of air pollution. It seeks to require emissions reductions via a command and control strategy for those facilities that are currently existing. It employs cutting-edge science from the OEHA guidelines, and it is, in our opinion, probably going to be the most health protective standard in the country. So the details of this have been worked out over the last couple of months. We've done extensive outreach to industry, and Jamie will fill you in on some of those efforts today. But the overall basically thing that I want to leave you with is that in addressing community health, we think that this is probably the gold standard. This is where everybody else will follow once we lead in this direction. So with that, I'll hand it over to Jamie.
Thank you, Chair Gioia and members of the Stationary Source Committee. I'll give you a summary of where we are with draft Regulation 11, Rule 18, a reduction of risk from toxic emissions at existing facilities. So just to summarize, cover a quick background, talk about the overview of the proposed Rule 11-18, our implementation approach, public engagement, and discuss next steps. So as Damien mentioned, this rule is focused on toxic air contaminants, and that's defined in the California Health and Safety Code as any air pollutant that may cause or contribute to an increase in mortality and present a potential hazard to human health. And this is really focused, again, on localized emissions and localized health impacts around our largest and most important stationary sources. So some of the key risk and impact measures when we're talking about toxic air contaminants are cancer burden, acute hazard index, and a chronic hazard index. So the cancer burden is really a theoretical probability for contracting cancer over the course of a lifetime. But you'll hear terms of 10 in a million or 25 in a million, and that's referencing the cancer burden. There are also measures of both acute impacts and chronic impacts that are non-cancerous, so asthma and other health effects that could impact residents in the area. So we have a series of stationary control programs and a series of incentive programs that we've been implementing and looking at driving down the lifetime residential cancer risk from toxic air contaminants. And you can see from starting in 1990, we're down about 80%. And now in 2014 with our latest numbers. The majority of that is still driven by diesel PM, but you can see some dramatic reductions over the course of the last 25 years in the cancer burden. And the various programs that we have in place today include stationary source control measures. We have CEQA, our Community Risk Evaluation Program, our CARE programs. As Damien mentioned, last December, we passed amendments to Rule 2.5, our toxic news source review. That addresses new equipment that generates toxic air contaminants, as well as modifications to that equipment. We have existing state program, Air Toxic Hotspots Program, AB 2588. And this Rule 11-18 really is, again, to focus on existing facilities. And to summarize, we do believe that this is the most comprehensive and health protective regulation in the nation to address community health impact risks from toxic air contaminants, specifically focused on stationary sources. We're utilizing air toxics modeling and incorporating the latest science from the Office of Environmental Health and Hazard Assessment to establish health risks to nearby communities. And we're going to ultimately be requiring facilities to reduce their overall risk to the most stringent threshold of 10 in a million. Again, that's the cancer burden. This is the most stringent threshold in the nation, or implement the best available control technologies for their operations. So as part of Rule 11-18, we have two health standards that we're looking at, starting with our proposed adoption and starting January 1, 2018, we would be requiring facilities to reduce their overall cancer risk to be below 25 in a million. Our current action level is 100 in a million, so you see that as a dramatic decrease. And then in 2020, we'd be looking at having facilities reduce their cancer risk below 10. The non-cancer acute and chronic hazard index would have respective values of 2.5 and 1.0 in 2018 and 2020. We believe this is going to affect approximately 400 facilities in the district. That includes refineries, power plants, hospitals, foundries, a wide variety of landfills. We have established a few exemptions for retail gas stations and facilities that only have diesel backup generators. And we're using a prioritization score. These are guidelines established by the state of California. And if their prioritization score is below 250, they would be exempt from this rule at this point in time. We do plan to address these source categories with some targeted rulemaking in the future. And we're coordinating with CAPCOA and the Air Resources Board on establishing some new guidelines, some industry-wide guidelines for addressing them. So in summary, we're going to require facilities that are above the risk action level to develop a risk reduction plan that they would submit to the Air District for approval, and they would have to execute that plan according to schedule. Some of the potential risk reduction measures they would have to implement include installation of best available retrofit control technology for toxics, which is a mouthful. We're calling that TBARCT, which is a new term we're defining. We have also the ability to modify their operating hours or activity levels or modification of their emission points. So this could be moving a stack or raising the stack to reduce the risk on the nearby community. So there's really two parts to the rule. And this actually happens before a facility would become subject to the rule. We would go through and actually update the risk characterization. So we start with prioritizing the facilities. Again, using that prioritization score calculation, there is time allocated to validate the data with each facility that we have. This would include activity levels and emission factors to make sure that they're up to date. We would be conducting health risk assessments based on that data that would be available for public comment and published to our website. And we've broken up.
Go ahead. I was going to ask something before you move on from this slide. Okay.
So we've broken up the facilities in approximately two phases. We think we have about 100 facilities in phase one, and those health risk assessments we expect to be done by 2019. And then phase two, which is about 300 facilities that would have prioritization scores between 10 and 250, those health risk assessments would be completed by 2021.
So we actually, are you saying that we actually have 100 facilities where we believe their health risk is above 250?
This is the prioritization score and not the health risk.
Oh.
So the prioritization score is a way for us to...
Can you go back to... I'm confused. So let me go... prioritization score... To go back, I just want to see how you're determining... I've been always used to understanding health risk because that's the measurement. So what goes into the prioritization score?
So the prioritization score looks at the actual reported emissions from the facility, and it looks like at a couple of other distance adjustment factors, and it's a rough prioritization mechanism to identify which facilities we want to look at first. The key thing there is that it's conservative, so if we know that the prioritization score is below 10, we know that their health mm-hmm. risk value cannot be above 10. So it allows us to screen out a significant number of facilities. So we've been doing that process first to help us order and prioritize the facilities. Then once we have them and we've identified that they're above 250 or above 10, we would then conduct the health risk assessment. And from the health risk assessment or the HRA, we actually get the health risk values and we get the acute and chronic right. values.
So one of the issues, and I think, and this gets back, combining this slide to your slide 9 on the exemptions. Exemptions are facilities with only diesel backup generators, like a hospital, facilities like that, right? So explain that further, because we want to, I think we changed that because we wanted to make sure that we didn't place a burden on important safety facilities like that that may only have a backup diesel generator that doesn't get used often, very infrequently.
Right.
So explain
right, Mr.
that
Chairman,
further.
I can explain both. Exemptions is probably not the right word because it implies that they'll never be addressed, and that's not our intent at all. I'll take gas stations first real quickly. Gas stations, there's some amount of technical disagreement between ourselves and the state about how much the nozzles themselves drip, believe it or not. When you take your nozzle out and you put it into your car, there's some disagreement over to how much they're actually contributing. And so we need to go through a whole set of additional source testing before we can ultimately define the emissions factor from the gas stations. And it's because they've changed the type of nozzles that are out there. Relative to diesel backup generators, this is one in which, for example, a hospital can have a whole bank of them. In fact, I think there are state laws requiring it.
Yes.
And it's not easily something that a hospital can change, first
That's
of all.
Correct.
In order to be able to really reduce the emissions from their diesel backup generators, oftentimes they need to be able to replace the entire diesel backup generators. One of the most important things you can do is just go from a Tier 0, which is one of the more dirtier diesel engines that are out there, to a Tier 3 or Tier 4. You have to pull the whole thing and replace it. So that's one in which we think we want to take a little bit more time to understand how best to implement a program to remove the toxic risk from sources that just have diesel backup generators that are driving their toxic.
So as I understand it in your note, these two areas will be addressed by a targeted rulemaking and implementation of industry-wide guidance in coordination with CAPCOA and the Air Resources Board, right?
We're not going to let CAPCOA, CARB, or others slow us down.
No.
It's just that we need to do some more work.
I'm just reading your footnote.
Right.
I'm reading your footnote.
I know, but I'm just adding more
so
to the
So what you're saying is those technically, I want to be clear, aren't covered in this rule.
That's
correct.
They
will be covered in a separate rulemaking, which is why the number of facilities went from over 800 down to about 400.
That's correct.
That's an important change that we want to make sure we all understand. I think there's a good reason for this, and I think this makes a lot of sense, but we're just trying to be clear that that's a change.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. I think I'll also add one last point about the diesel backup generators. This is one in which we're going to need to think through also about making monies available to the people, because we're talking about oftentimes elementary schools and other types of sources like that that we're going to need to, I think, use all the tools in our toolkit.
So when you calculated the risk, health risk, did you assume – how do you assume how often that generator is used? In other words, when you're calculating a health risk of 30 in a million, what assumptions are you using in terms of the operation of that diesel backup generator?
Yeah, so per the CAPCOA guidelines, which we are implementing, and we've implemented as part of 2.5 when that was adopted, amended, we look at only their testing hours, so we don't actually, if there was an emergency and had to use those hours, we don't consider those.
So this looks at their testing protocols, because they test them, they do test them with some frequency.
Yes, so they would have existing permit conditions that allow, 20 to 50 hours typically of testing.
Okay, thank you. This is helpful, and I think making this change really accommodates folks who were concerned about cost, especially public safety, right? And at some point, will you have a list of the types of facilities that are in phase one and phase two?
We can break that out,
I think for the public and for us, I think it's important to understand the types of facilities here for full disclosure that would be in phase one or phase two.
There's a mix of pretty much everything, but there's some exceptions that would only be in phase one or phase two. So.
Yes. Director Miley?
Yeah, and also with that list.
And Director Haggerty, yes.
Yeah. Will you also be making that, giving us kind of an indication of these facilities per county? Because I know people have already been talking to me. I know you'll get the public engagement a little bit sooner, but can we get a sense of who we're dealing with? Because I'd like to know who I'm dealing with in Alameda County, for instance.
Yes, we do have an updated list that is based on this estimated 400 facilities identified by county and city, so we can provide that to the respective board members.
Thank you.
Director Haggerty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just tag on with Director Marley real quick on the public engagement. Are we going back out? Because I've noticed that you went to Hayward, you went to Fremont, you went to San Jose, but yet there was no kind of like the eastern Alameda County, Contra Costa area that probably would be of great interest. And so are we going back out? Are we going to do another round? What are we doing?
That's in the presentation, so if we can just move forward to that portion, I think we'll be able to explain. But our intent is to do exactly that.
Okay, and then...
And also, we'd like your help, obviously, because your folks are on the ground there to contact facilities that you may identify through these lists and help us to make the introductions there.
So, through the rule, and I've heard a lot about cancer risk and things like that, how are we going to deal with VOCs? And for example, I noticed sewer treatment plants are on there, and I don't know what is going on out in the Livermore one, but I literally have to quit breathing when I drive by it. And it's not a really healthy practice, because sometimes, you know, there's a stoplight there and it's trying to hold your breath for a very long time as I'm afraid I'm going to pass out, but it's a choice between smelling it or I don't need to know my neighbors that well, to be honest with you. And then they're constantly flaring there, and so they're burning methane, correct? And to me, it seems like that may be like an old antiquated type system, to where, you know, I'm hoping that this rule is going to catch some of the stuff that will make that facility upgrade, because, you know, at 586-80, there's a series of ponds that, quite frankly, they used to smell, but they've done a lot of upgraded new technology in that area that we don't catch the VOCs anymore. But in Livermore, something is going on. So I'm just curious, what are we going to do to protect? I know we're talking about cancer risk, but what are we going to do to protect people that live in the area, say, around that facility? And I don't know if that facility is on your radar, if, you know, you get complaints about it, but you should.
I can answer, Director Haggerty. We, the sewage treatment facilities all over the Bay Area are ones in which we are paying particularly close attention to. They are sources of not only odors, but also toxic risk. We met with the Bay Area Clean Water Association.
My staff has.
Yeah, and they came in knowing that we were working on this, so we've had multiple meetings with them. Indeed, we moved them to the second phase largely because they asked to be able to build into their capital improvement budgets steps that they're going to need to take in order to reduce their overall exposure in the communities surrounding the sewage treatment facility. So there's a very good cooperative working relationship, I'd say, between ourselves and the sewage treatment facility people, because they know themselves are going to need to invest in some increase.
And I don't know if you want to add something to that, but, you know, from my standpoint, moving them to the second phase, so what year does that put them out to? Or how long?
Well, it's going to be a while, largely because some of their upgrades they're going to have to take is some pretty significant construction. But Jamie?
Yeah, so the it basically means that their HRAs are targeting to start in 2019. So it's not actually moving them out too significantly of a change there. In the meantime, we are actually working with them to validate their emission factors, get a better understanding of their operations, and discuss the particular ways in which these projects or existing capital improvement projects may actually suffice to reduce risk. So there's work that's going to be going on as we gear up to conduct updated health risk assessments, and ultimately they would be looking to implement if they're over 25, that would go in effect as soon as we finish the HRA in terms of submitting that risk reduction plan, and then if they were between the 10 and 25 range, you know, that risk plan would be due 2020.
So I realize I'm not going to endear myself with the Bay Area Clean Water Authority, but what I would say is, you know, they're the government.
And yeah. And I think sometimes when we rule things out like, or when we rule things out like this, we shouldn't be forcing, we shouldn't be moving them out to the second phase. They should be leading by example. And we should be saying, look, you guys, I mean, and I can tell you that in my community that I represent, they're probably one of the biggest problems in my estimation. I don't think we should allow them to go to phase two. I think they should be phase one. I think they should be leading by example. And I think as we do rules like this, we should continue to force the government to lead by example. Because how do you get business to follow if we're saying, okay, well, look, we're going to move you guys out to, we want to understand you a little bit more. We're going to roll you out to phase two. But yet some of these other private entities are going to be stuck in phase one. I don't think that's right.
No, we understand, Director Haggerty. Largely it had to do with, we were convinced that some of the investment plans and the capital improvements, right. that's what it's coming down to, just the practical implementation of the steps they need to reduce their risk.
You don't think business has that same burden?
We do. But I do believe that they're going to take a little bit longer in order to be able to figure out a way to pay for it is the issue. And so
I have a really hard time buying that. I really do, Jack. I'm sorry. But quite frankly, they're not a social service agency. They're not going to suck it up. I mean, the people are the ones that are going to ultimately pay for it. And so I just, you know, they actually have a better mechanism than business has.
So Scott raises a good point. It sounds like what you were trying to do was balance this issue of concern about rate increases to these to ratepayers. Was that the issue? So would folks?
It's really just strictly the amount of time it takes in order to make an amendment to a fairly capital intensive.
Would they need amendments through their, like if they're wastewater plants, through the Regional Water Quality Control Board? Is that part of it? Amendments from the regional board? I mean, some of these entities would realistically may raise rates to cover that. I used to be on the East Bay Mud Board, which is water and wastewater, so I'm familiar with that for 10 years. And so ultimately, were you hearing potential rate increases from wastewater agencies?
They talked to us a little bit about that, but just picture some of these ponds going to have to be domed, for example. Yeah.
Actual physical hard infrastructure that needs to go in. So these folks are also dealing with diversion of waste. A lot of them want to end the flaring that Director Haggerty's talking about and move to systems that recapture energy. So there's a lot of capital investment that will need to occur. And as we looked at that, the time scale for that is probably over the next 5 years. So by pushing them back a little bit, we give them a chance to get those actions in place, going to their boards, going to the Regional Water Quality Control Board, and then raising the capital and actually doing the planning permitting to get these physical infrastructure projects off the ground.
And what you see here in terms of our recommendation comes as a result of a lot of push and pulling back and forth with ourselves and those agencies, by the way. This wasn't something we did automatically. We did it after.
Well, I mean, having been on a wastewater board for 10 years, these people, I mean, they have to get the money from somewhere, and the money is, I mean, if sometimes they're issuing bonds and sometimes they're raising rates. It may be a mix depending on the agency or both. That's correct.
So the next phase in the actual rule is looking at the risk reduction side of things. So,
And go into more detail on this chart because I think that we'll get a lot of questions about the timing. This is a very general chart. I think you should try to go into more on this last element, how long it's going to take, what are the different sort of opportunities.
Yeah, so, starting in 2018, if we've conducted a health risk assessment that results in a cancer burden above 25, then a facility would be notified and they would be required to prepare and submit a risk reduction plan within 180 days of that notification.
So day one is notification of, can you start with the time frame of when we're thinking of adoption, sort of go out in real time frames of, because that's how the public understands it. I get asked these questions. When are we're looking at potential adoption in?
So proposing adoption in November of this year, November 15th, I believe is the date.
Correct.
And so the rule would go into effect January 1, 2018. And so we would go through the series of activities starting here, and this is all going to be rolling and running parallel, targeting the phase one facilities initially, of prioritizing them, validating the data, conducting the health risk assessments, doing public comment and publishing the results ultimately. And we expect that to take between 6 to 18 months to complete.
So phase one will prepare and submit risk reduction plans by, what's the timeline they have to submit their risk reduction plan?
So once they've been notified that they're above the risk action level, they have 180 days to submit that risk reduction plan.
So it's like 6 months.
Yes.
So if I can, Mr. Chairman and Jamie.
And when will they get notified?
I mean, the staff itself is the ones that's actually in charge of the inventorying back and forth and making sure that we agree with all the very specific emissions points, the data. This is something the board insisted that we be in charge of, not giving it back to the facilities. And that's fine, but that also what gets built into the
time frame. Yeah, that time is built into the process. So after that risk reduction plan is submitted, we estimate it's about 180 days, up to 180 days, depending on our ability to evaluate and approve that. We have included a public comment period on that as well, and ultimately we'll be publishing at least a non-confidential version of that. Without the confidential information, version of that risk reduction plan. And then once that plan is approved, there's an initial period of 5 years to implement the risk reduction measures. That's to allocate time for preparation and submission of any required permit applications and the evaluation of those permit applications, and then obviously the ability to actually build and install those. And there is a provision to allow for an extension if the facility can demonstrate either a technical feasibility issue or economic burden. Again, this is, we've talked about the wastewater agencies, something that may apply to them based on their capital projects and planning, but would be extended and available for a facility of any industry in that situation.
So, and then the compliant, this implementation, talk a bit more about the implementation timeline.
So the implementation timeline, that's that 5 years. Right. They have up to 5 years to implement all the measures. We would be, monitoring the results and verifying that they've gotten below the risk action level. In either case, if it's the 25 in a million or 10 in a million, their risk reduction plan has to get them below 10. So even though there's sort of a two-year window when the risk action level is lowered, even the facilities that are over 25 have to demonstrate how they're going to get below 10. So the goal here is to get everyone below that 10 in a million risk action level.
So they're doing it all at once, and it's not a phased approach to 25 or to 10. It's getting folks to 10.
Their risk reduction plans, if they are in if they fall into the rule, they would be required to get below 10.
Right.
Yes.
They could either do it all at once or do it incrementally with the series of improvements.
Yes.
Depending what they determine is best as they put forward within the 5-year time frame.
And there may be opportunities for facilities to proactively get below 10, prior to the 2020 threshold being established.
Yes. Nate? Yeah.
Yeah, just real quickly. So with this time frame, when they submit their plans, and I don't know if you guys have thought this through yet, but how will you evaluate their plan to determine whether or not what they're proposing is something that we find not only acceptable, but the time, the duration, as well as what they're proposing to do.
So we would be looking, if they're proposing control technology, we would be looking at the control technology to see if it's appropriate, if we think it's the best available retrofit control technology, and we could expect to get the emission reductions that we planned. They're looking at moving sort of the source or location of where the emissions are emitted. We can look at the modeling and how that would update our health risk assessment to kind of prove that out.
Okay, so there won't be like a cookie cutter approach to one category of industry. It's going to be unique based on each plan, huh?
It's the emissions and this particular equipment. That's why this rule is so comprehensive, because it has to look at all source categories that emit toxic air contaminants and what the appropriate controls would be for that, and as well as the location of where they're being emitted on the facility, and as well as the location of residents or workers outside of the facility.
And when they submit their plan, will they also include in that plan the cost associated with implementation? Is that one of the factors?
If they're requesting an extension, then we care about that, but we otherwise will not necessarily be evaluating that cost if we believe that the control technology is appropriate.
We will, as part of the socioeconomic analysis for the proposed rulemaking.
For the overall rule,
for what you're going to, for the overall rule, that's what, Dr. Miley, you'll have in front of you, what we believe are going to be the cost of implementing this rule, but on a facility-by-facility basis, only until they request.
Yes, so cost is not necessarily a factor unless it's requested for an extension.
Okay.
So just to summarize the public engagement and outreach we've done so far, starting going back to actually November 2016, we had a series of workshops running through March in various parts of the Bay Area. We had a draft environmental impact report and public and rule language that was published. Originally, this was in conjunction with 1216, but we had two public comment periods, October through December, as well as March 2nd through April 30th earlier this year. As we've mentioned, we have a couple of additional engagements with specific industries that had concerns. So we spoke with the Bay Area Clean Water Agencies, the California Metals Coalition, CEEB, the California Council on Economic and Environmental and Economic Balance, and had a conference call with the Hospital Council in particular. And we've had several discussions with WISPA as well. So next steps, we've actually published several of these documents already starting September 1st, but we have sort of the final hearing package, which is going out. That includes the public hearing notice, that proposed adoption date of November 15th, updated proposed rule language. We have the staff report, socioeconomic analysis, recirculated draft EIR that's focused just on 1118. We have a T-barked workbook that's actually going to go out. This is not officially needing to be adopted by the board, but this is where we've identified all of the source categories that we believe are emitting toxics that are significant and potential control technologies. So this is something that will be managed and maintained very similar to our BACT workbook, and we're in discussions with the state relative to AB 617 of how this might play into a statewide clearinghouse for toxics control technologies, and that'll be managed and maintained at this point by the engineering division. And public comments on these will be due October 16th.
So if I recall, Jamie, we're going to be coming back out as to the Tri-Valley also. That's what was ever requested.
Yeah, so what we were planning on doing is actually sending a mailing package to the facilities that are all on the list so that we can get additional feedback and comments. We had not scheduled an actual physical meeting in Tri-Valley, but that's something we can try to do, or at least get a webinar on the calendar so we can have some formal, another opportunity for feedback.
Director Groom?
Thank you. Could you give Supervisor Canepa and I some language or a copy of something that we can put on our website, since there didn't seem to have been a meeting in San Mateo County? At least so that we can start letting people know.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it seems to be there was a gap here for the peninsula and the North Bay. I mean, Benicia sort of, but there was no North Bay or San Mateo meeting.
Yeah. Largely, I don't know if there's going to be a large facilities in that area that are going to be triggering these risks, but let us, you know,
or maybe you could give us a list and we can make that determination. That would be helpful as well.
One thing we did do as part of our initial outreach was we did contact every facility. We emailed them. We sent them notifications of the regulation. And we will, as part of this next outreach effort, go back, redouble that effort. We think that there'll be a lot of interest, I think, in the TBAC workbook, which is where a lot of facilities can look and think about what some of the costs of this may be.
You know, sometimes it would be helpful if you gave us that list as well.
And I think that's actually part of the work that we want to do now. As we come to this last portion, it's important that we get input from all those facilities. So we'll take that as direction to bring those lists back to you, bring those packages back to you. And then if there's contact that you need for the staff to make to those facilities, we'll be happy to follow up.
That would be great.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I just wanted to echo what Carol said. If you can provide us those lists, that'd be great, Damien. And I wanted to recognize you, Jamie. This has really been such a long process, and it's really moving forward at such an impressive rate. So in September, the socioeconomic analysis report, is that available now, or is that coming out in September?
It'll be available in about a week or two. So we can notify you once it's posted.
Yeah, can you post that and share that? The reason is I just want to kind of just do my due diligence. The other thing I wanted to commend staff on, and we had talked about this earlier, was around the gas stations. And sort of, Jack had said, we talked about exemptions. That probably wasn't the right word to use, and you're right in saying that. I guess what I'm curious to, and I saw something relative to the additional public engagement. You had a conference call with the Hospital Council on, was it August 30th, 2017? What were some of their concerns? Was it solely just around the generators, Jamie, or was there anything in addition?
That's the major concern at this point. So they do have a couple of other sources that have toxic emissions, really addressing the generator issue is a major concern. So, and there's some regulation that requires them to be how many generators they have and operational. And so their concern was what are the costs involved, and physically, and do they have the physical space to make changes? We're really trying to talk through those and address those issues.
Because the issue is they have by state law, it was a state law passed years ago. They have the structural mandate by 2020, correct? In regards to all making sure all seismic, making sure all the hospitals
yes.
are. And then one last question around the generators. Do you know where the technology is around, greener generators or anything around that?
Well, I think as Jack mentioned, there are newer engines, tier four engines that are on the market, and they're talking about tier five engines that are significantly cleaner. There are just very few options on the market right now, and they're quite expensive. So that's where the concern is. You know, over time, we would expect those costs to come down and more models to be available. The adoption rate just hasn't been as quick as I think it anticipated originally.
Thank you.
Go for it.
Are you taking other questions?
Yes, questions.
I don't know if you're aware of this, but our county supervisor in my area informed us that they expect the local cement plant to be opening a new pit or asking for an application to do that from the county. I suppose in my area it's the equivalent of somebody coming in and wanting to open a whole new refinery. Mm-hmm. So it would be certainly helpful if the district prioritized activities with regard to air quality for cement facilities, of which there are one in the Bay Area in its first phase.
So I think we'd have two tools ultimately to address that. So one is if they're opening a new pit and they'd have new equipment or modifying their operation, they would have to go through a permitting process, and they would be subject to, we essentially have a project limit of 10 in a million. So their facility-wide operations ultimately will have to be down at that project risk level of 10 in a million as well. So,
well, my belief is they're exhausting the material they can extract from the first pit, so they will be moving to another adjacent area, but digging a whole new hole, blasting a whole new mountain away, and probably using the same kiln facilities that they're currently using. So with regard to this rule, I would certainly appreciate consideration that they be put into the first phase if, in fact, they qualify under these regulations.
Yeah, I think we can take a look at where the prioritization score ends up, but can understand the concerns. So.
It'll be a huge big deal.
If
if it helps. We're almost positive that it's going to be in the first phase. Yeah. It's going to be considered to be a high risk source. High risk.
Yeah. Jamie, I think he's being cautious because he doesn't have a list in front of him, but I think that's how it broke.
The current pit is about a mile across, so this will be a huge environmental impact to our community. And if the Air District is leading in working on air quality, I mean, we've made so much progress with the new stack. You know, mercury is down 90%, NOx and SOx are down, PM is down appreciably thanks to the efforts of this Air District. I know that continued efforts in my community coming from the Air District will be well appreciated in a time period when, you know, the county is evaluating this application. So they have jurisdiction over permitting of this new excavation. Thank you.
And in addition to that, wouldn't the county sort of be obligated to look at, those CEQA guidelines that we passed a few years ago that require that really are the best practice guidelines, so that look at health risks? So the county should be, and I'm sure we'll write a comment letter to them, but the county, these guidelines that were passed, I'm not sure if it was right before you got on the board, that were then litigated, but they're still out there, that would require agencies to look at thresholds of significance for this kind of, for expansions like this.
Oh, that's true. I just to manage expectations, as we've all been out there many times to that facility, the quarry may or may not have stationary equipment in it. More than likely, it has a lot of diesel-based equipment, right, moving around. So that's going to have to be something that we take into account. I'm just trying to make sure you know the picture as we see it.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yes. Brad?
We're going to be doing... I'm just making sure. We're going to be doing 100 health assessments.
So we think there are about 400 facilities. Ultimately, we'd be looking at, you know, some of those may drop off. So we're estimating about 250 to 300 health risk assessments per year.
And we're
total.
So our staff is going to be doing those.
So we have one is we've requested additional staff to help cover this.
I was thinking
effort. This was at the board direction to have these health risk assessments done internally. Not by the facilities. We have also allocated about $1.2 million in this year's budget for consulting help, where the district would hire consultants where needed to help refine and conduct the health risk assessments at our direction. So,
yeah, the whole strength of this program is going to be on the ability for the staff to be able to do those and to move it forward.
We're trying very hard to make sure that you know, we have a transparent process as well. So building in timelines for public comment are in there as well. So.
Good, and I just want to hook on to the San Mateo question about. Let me know who's in my neck of the woods that I need to be looking at, and so that I can be hearing from them and understanding what their concerns are. Thank you.
Other questions? I have just a couple. One, just to be clear, because I think this came up at the very beginning, and just being crystal clear. We are actually working to prepare the health risk analysis. None of the facilities are preparing them themselves.
That's correct.
They will be the facilities will be paying for the implementation of this measure.
That's
right?
Correct. And we are planning to hire, just to build on Director Wagenknecht's comments, we're going to be hiring more engineers and are in the process of doing that.
Right. And on the PM issue, so the only PM that's covered under this rule is the PM that comes from diesel engines.
Yes.
Not condensable PM, let's say, comes from refineries, from units like the FCC units at refineries. So is there a time, I realize that, Jack, and why don't you just briefly speak about the PM efforts, and I know you're going to talk more about that on Wednesday, but just I think it's important. I want to understand the PM, the general PM efforts that are you're looking at other rules that are not within this rule. That's part one. And then part two of that question is there a time when different standards are created where condensable PM would get covered under this rule?
I'm going to let Gene
It's always been, you know, something I've learned. I mean, that you have PM that's toxic and PM that's criteria pollutants.
Right. It's a criteria contaminant in that it is there is a national standard in the air for PM. But we also know that there's diesel PM, PM that is from a diesel equipment, and it's a diesel particulate in the air. The issue is you have equipment out there like furnaces at refineries that emit PM, that it's technically inappropriate to apply the diesel PM to that in terms of understanding and characterizing its toxic risk.
And why is that?
Well, because the PM itself, when it was analyzed and there was a reference exposure level, which is the term in BART that's used in the scientific community to understand how it creates cancer, how it impacts the body, that is related to the very explicit type of PM that's emitted into the air from a diesel piece of equipment. That's not to say that that PM from a furnace at a refinery doesn't have those impacts, but it's inappropriate to apply that same type of impacts to a PM that's generated from a furnace. It's just technically and scientifically not appropriate to do that. So that tends to, in our minds, leave a little bit of a gap. So good news is that we did sit down, talk with OEHA, the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, and they've come back and said that they want to work with us to be able to figure out how to create that missing set of information for that PM. Gene, do you want to add my remarks?
So they did, as Jack mentioned, they did send us a letter committing to work with us on that. They're also going to be part of our advisory council's discussions upcoming at the end of October. On that particular issue in terms of PM and how we fold it into our analysis of protecting public health. So from the PM and the toxic air contaminant side, that's some good progress. We're really glad to hear that OEHA is going to take this up and take it seriously. That's really great news. And just in general on PM, we do have a suite of rules that we will be bringing to you in the first quarter of next year.
Are you going
to
summarize that on Wednesday?
That's correct.
I think on Wednesday on the agenda item that we have.
That agenda item is about refinery specifically.
Right. So I understand. There's a lot of condensable PM coming from furnaces around the Bay Area that are not at refineries.
Right, and the suite of PM rules that I was mentioning. So we'll talk about the 20% by 2020 on Wednesday for refineries.
Right.
But we have a suite of particulate matter rules that will affect all sources of particulate matter that is very important because that will affect communities around the whole region.
Right. Okay.
So as this scientific work with OEHA unfolds, evolves, we'll then incorporate that into the HRAs that have been prepared and are being prepared by the sources that have those PM. So that's something that we will closely let the board know how that's actually getting incorporated into this work. And it's going to essentially require us to, I think, keep this committee and the full board apprised as it moves forward.
Okay. Thank you. Any closing comments by you before I go to questions and speakers?
There's just one other thing I wanted to mention is, you know, one of the things we have built into the rule is a review every 10 years at the best available retrofit control technology, with the understanding that we have a mechanism to reevaluate as, you know, technologies and operations become cleaner and more cost-effective that could be applied to these facilities. So it's something that we see as an ongoing effort and a mechanism to look at additional reductions.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments by board members? I have several speaker cards. Stephen Yang, followed by Bill Quinn, followed by Janet Stromberg. Those are the first three.
I have to leave in a moment. Because I have to get the ferry.
Okay. And if Director Ragenknecht leaves during your comments, it's not disrespect. He has to catch a ferry because they don't leave that often.
No.
I'm not Stephen Yang. I'm Bill Quinn. I think he's stepped
Bill
out.
Quinn.
So, Bill
are,
Quinn.
Yes.
Good morning, members of the board and Mr. Chairman. Bill Quinn again with CEEB, California Council for Environmental and Economic Balance. So on this rule, I agree with the chairman's comments and Jack's comments. This is one of the most important rules of recent years to protect public local health. We've been pleased to work closely with staff throughout the rule development process. We also believe, as I'm sure you do, a well-designed rule is important to public health of the Bay Area. Yet, SEEP still has some remaining comments and concerns on the draft rule 1118. First, given the stringency of the proposed risk action level, many facilities will need to implement best available control technology for toxics, or TBAC. This is a new and untested regulatory concept. SEEP asks that you direct staff to work with stakeholders to define TBARC through a guidance document as part of the rulemaking and align it with other BARC rules by considering cost effectiveness and technological feasibility as mandated by the California Health and Safety Code. Second, we asked the board to allow pre-qualified independent third-party consultants to conduct the health risk assessments. I know this was a topic you've talked about quite a bit. We believe it's still the best way. This would be consistent with what you do with Rule 2.5 and with 2588. SEEP believes that without this option, many large facilities would be compelled to hire their own consultants to confirm district findings. The use of pre-qualified, independent third-party consultants creates greater efficiency and accuracy and allows staff to focus on ensuring public health outcomes. Third, we seek the inclusion of a dispute resolution process as part of this rule. CBAC advocates for transparency and asks that the board direct staff to create a mechanism that allows facilities to appeal inventories on health risk assessments that they believe to be inaccurate. The potential for disputes comes from at least two possible areas. First, a facility may find inaccuracies with a district-prepared health risk assessment. And second, there could be questions raised by facilities about any changes made because of public comments staff has accepted into the final health risk assessment. SEEP believes that allowing both independent third-party consultants to prepare health risk assessments and a mechanism for dispute resolution is warranted to minimize the potential for disagreement and to increase transparency. The board should allow either the hearing board to decide appeals or clearly identify a process within the rule to ensure dispute resolution. SEEP will be submitting comments on other technical written comments on this proposal as well. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Janet Stromberg, followed by Bob Brown, followed by Bob Harlow.
Good morning, Janet Stromberg, 350 Bay Area. First, I want to say that Jack's characterization of proposed Rule 1118 as the most comprehensive in health protective regulation in the nation to adjust community health impacts from toxic air pollutants is absolutely accurate. I'm really proud to have a past association with the agency that's taking this step, and it's great. A question I have is regarding the phase two implementation. It looks to me from slide 11, combining 11 and 12, that at the health risk assessments would be totally completed for the phase two by 2021, and then the implementation is 5 to 10 years beyond that. And I think that might be necessary. But going back to slide 9 and the what's being called an exemption, although was qualified, I think the explanation about needing to resolve the issue of the gas nozzles was reasonable. But with regard to backup diesel generators, the question that I have, first of all, is how many of these facilities have prioritization scores between 10 and 250? Because if we're looking at implementation of up to 10 years beyond 2021, I don't really see why we would not include those in the phase two with the other facilities. And regarding backup diesel generators in particular, especially I would say in the score area between 10 and 250, these are widely distributed activities that really impact millions of Bay Areans. These are not focused in industrial areas. These are things that we are all going to breathe. And when we do the emission calculations for permitting these engines, we're only calculating the emissions that happen during their testing every year. And so we're not really looking at the impacts of when they're actually used for the purpose that they were put in there. So I think we need to look, it's kind of past time to really look at the impact of diesel generators, which are the highest volume permit applications coming through this agency, and start thinking about phasing them out. Because if we're going to do sometime after 10 years, after 2021, we're really looking way down the road, when the information that I've read is that in the past, diesel generators were needed for certain types of operations, but that the technologies of other fuels have come to the point that diesel generators are actually, could almost be considered obsolete for the vast majority of them. And so I urge you to look more carefully at this and not just accept this. I'd like to know a list of the companies that are fitting in that exemption.
You raise a good point. I'm going to address after, too.
Janet, I have a question for you. Sorry. Are you suggesting natural gas fuel cells, or what's the alternative if I'm looking for a backup source of electricity that's on site?
When we're looking at a date that's maybe out to 2031, I think in the near term, I would say that probably we could phase out permitting diesel generators, because those particulate filters are known to be very problematic. And so even the actual emissions that result from those are not working on the diesel generators. Ultimately, far out in the future, hopefully we're going to have some kind of distributed clean generation options. Maybe, you know, I forget what the term is when you have smaller.
I understand. But so my city hall is operating on a generator that's 50, 60 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were I to replace that,
Natural gas, I would say.
Yeah, so okay, yeah. Fuel cells.
But I think your point is well taken on moving out. I mean, at the California Air Resources Board, we've been looking at setting dates in the future beyond which vehicles like buses and trucks would not be diesel any longer. They would be whether it's hydrogen fuel cell, battery electric, and to replace. So, I mean, Jack, how do we sort of factor that in? I mean, there is, in fact, clearly a trend on the transportation side to move toward having dates, again, off in the future. That date has not been set, in which we transition beyond diesel engines.
Well, first of all, Mr. Chairman, I'll just mention that Ms. Stromberg's comments are very well taken, and we're in complete agreement that this is an area that really deserves a lot of focus, a lot of attention, and I would agree that we should come to a point where we don't permit these in the future,
right,
because they are ubiquitous. They're in every neighborhood. The question is just how do you make that happen, we actually have some, we think, about 7,000 backup generators actually permitted by the district, and we think there's a lot of them out there that aren't even in our system that need to be. So the answer to the question in terms of where do you transition to?
Cummings, which is the largest diesel engine manufacturer in the world, announced recently, as you heard out of Sylmar, that they're coming out in 2019 with a non-diesel engine. And ARB is looking at setting some dates to transition diesel engines out of transportation. So I just think some thought needs to be given here. I think that
it does.
Because once you've invested in it, it's there. And there are alternatives developing that are just as effective and are clean. And that's where the technology is going for stationary as well as. Right.
Absolutely. There's actually what's exciting is you have Bloom Energy, for example, a big company down in Silicon Valley. It's essentially a stationary fuel cell application, and that's the new Apple campus has them installed. So how do we get that into everyday commercial applications everywhere? That's what the Technology Implementation Office is going to hopefully lead us down that path.
Great. So maybe I think that would be useful for us to understand maybe when you come back further, because if let's say someone's got 10 years out, the technology is going to be totally different what we're seeing in 10 years. I mean, the market share of the non-diesel.
As Jack said, that this is our intention is for this to be one of our focus areas to our Technology Implementation Office. In our kind of preview of that, We'll be talking to you, I think, more about this at our executive committee, but we understand that that's an area where technology is developing at a rapid pace.
Very fast.
I think the real issue right there now is it's not that the technology can't perform the same thing. It's the cost of the technologies right. and making those
decisions. But in 10 years, the estimate is the cost of that technology is going to dramatically be less than today. Hydrogen fuel cell, right.
Yeah, but you made the correct assumption saying that, you know, when you lock into technology, when you lock into infrastructure, diesel infrastructure will last you 20, 30 years. That's why it's been such an issue for us.
Right.
It's because of that robustness. So through the TIO, we're going to be looking at that and seeing, is there a way that we can shift people there possibly early using different financing mechanisms and other things that are available.
Right.
Okay. Bob Brown, followed by Bob Harlow, followed by Charles Davidson. And then if... I think who left? Stephen Yang's not here.
I think he had to leave.
Okay.
Good morning, Chairman Gioia and members. Bob Brown with the Western States Petroleum Association. We're going to have our own comments in detail in a letter form here by the mid-October deadline, but I wanted to talk a little bit about the 10 versus 25 and a million and risk in general. Risk is a probability, so 10 in a million risk means there's 1/1,000th of 1% chance that a maximum exposed person will contract cancer. And this assumes a person is outdoors, exposed to the highest toxic concentration 24/7 for 30 years. Now, it's purposely conservative, meaning it assumes the worst in order to be health protective. But to put this in perspective, the Bay Area background risk from air toxics is 800 in a million, and more than 85% of risk coming from diesel PM. Total cancer risk from all causes, genetics, diet, smoking, et cetera, is about 400,000 in a million, or 40%. In 2016, in July, staff presented a two-step program that started with 25 in a million risk reduction threshold, consistent with South Coast and San Joaquin Valley. 25 in a million would increase the risk reduction threshold by a factor of 7 or more, and the second step would then take all facilities down to 10 in a million. 1118, though, eliminates that 25 in a million step altogether. 10 in a million is 30 times more stringent than the current threshold. And as been pointed out, I think it treats facilities differently in their phased approach. And we, too, would welcome seeing that list as it's bifurcated on the 400. But most importantly, we'd like to see the technical assessment of 25 in a million included so that the board can compare this with a 10 in a million proposal. We'd also like to see this examined in the EIR and hopefully in the socioeconomic analysis, which I understand comes out later this month. Thank you.
Bob Harlow.
Charles Davidson.
Greetings. My name is Charles Davidson from Hercules. And the Sunflower Alliance. Rule 1118 is not a bad rule. It is needed, but not without a carbon cap. A few points about current 1118 deficiencies. Number one, 1118 is generally designed to contain toxic pollutants, but is not a CO2 greenhouse gas cap, nor a general carbon emissions cap or PM cap. Two, 1118 does not address specific disease-causing particulate matter PM2.5 emissions, which have mostly risen in the Bay Area within the past two decades, before the multiple currently planned heavy crude capacity expansion projects proceed. Number three, 1118 risks being a retrofit/post-project endeavor by promoting future and undefined ad hoc retrofits to correct major predictable emissions violations. 1118 also risks being a smokescreen for a planned major expansion of PM-causing extra-heavy bitumen/tar sands crude refining in the Bay Area. A case in point about 1118's likely missing huge toxic local targets, which is Phillips 66 Refinery's marine terminal expansion and tar sands refining project in Rodeo. The Phillips 66 San Francisco Refinery's currently proposed marine terminal expansion project would be a fourfold increase in wharf delivery capacity since 2012, and which is and would most likely receive Canadian tar sands bitumen, which is the most dense and sulfurous crude oil ever available globally. The project would likely bring in by ship the equivalent of 2-mile-long trains of solvent-diluted tar sands called Dilbit per day, now greatly facilitated by British Columbia's recent permit for Kinder Morgan's Trans Mountain Pipeline. Phillips 66's carbon plant, which is the highest sulfur dioxide emission source in Northern California, now processes 90 truckloads per day of coal-like raw pet coke, which is about 0.5 million tons per year, or 1 billion pounds. The EPA states that 20 to 30% of raw pet coke is consumed by combustion in coke calcining in order to make graphite carbon. This means that around 100,000 tons of pet coke is currently combusted only 250 yards from people's homes. Most likely, the plant emits many, many hundreds of tons of PM yearly, which is a highly significant amount, yet Phillips 66 has no PM monitors anywhere. Air District engineers have stated to me that Bay Area refineries do not burn pet coke. I have two questions. Why not a cap on both types of refinery carbon emissions, CO2, greenhouse gases, and PM? And two, how can a prevention of significant deterioration, PSD argument support a refinery emissions cap for all carbon combustion emissions within the framework of a new source review pertaining to crude slate changes and or equipment modifications or operational changes which allow a major increase in bitumen refining? Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was the last speaker card I had. So maybe just to understand, how are you going to come back on the on this whole issue of the diesel? Because I do think...
Mr. Chairman, that it's going to take some time, though, and this is something we want to...
But how do you have language that doesn't lock in, let's say, in a plan that may be approved in 5 years, someone replacing with diesel?
I think the whole idea of backup generators and diesel backup generators is a fairly comprehensive discussion we have to have separately with the board on this. There's some complexities here about the sources. How do we affect change? How do we get moving forward so you can just basically stop having diesel generators being permitted in the district? That's one step. One, two, how do you deal with those, the existing infrastructure, get them moved into something like fuel cells and things like that? That just requires a fairly complex assessment all by itself. I'd like to be able to concentrate in the short term to get 1118 in front of you, so hopefully adopted. And Mr. Chairman, then I would put that on an agenda sometime after that. But we do have staff internally doing that homework. If I can, though, following up on this, the board has asked us for lists of facilities in their jurisdictions. We'll provide that. There's also been a request for additional outreach in other parts of the Bay Area. We'll also look at that and conduct that effort as well. So that's our takeaways. Are we looking at anything else? As staff, Mr. Chairman, that's what okay. We see.
All right. Any other comments? Okay. Committee member comments? None. Next meeting, Monday, October 16th, here at 10:30. We are adjourned.